a meditation retreat, and there's many things one can say about the technique of meditation, its goals, and how to achieve those goals. And this morning I want you to describe how the Buddha taught the meditation on the breath, basically going through what we know as the Anapana Sati Sutta of the Buddha. And I'm going to describe this teaching in order to bring out a few very important points on how to gain success in meditation, and also to show its depth and profundity, and to answer the question which many people ask, is how does this whole process of meditation on the breath relate to the arising of wisdom, and insight, enlightenment? Certainly that when I was a young monk, I thought, well, surely the Buddha must have taught something about meditation in the suttas. Where was that teaching? And this is the main place where the Buddha taught meditation. He described his own practice called Anapanasati, the mindfulness which goes along with the breath. And when he taught that teaching, he taught it in 16 steps. And the first 12 of those steps were the instructions of how to get into jhanas. And the last 4 of those steps is what to do when you emerge from jhanas. And this was the Buddha's own practice. It was through gaining the jhanas under the Bodhi tree and emerging afterwards that the Buddha found the solution to what he was searching for many lifetimes. Wisdom arose under that Bodhi tree. And ever since that time, the wisdom has arisen to many people. The same wisdom, seeing the same thing which the Buddha saw, in their own words, in their own minds, in their own experience. But still that wisdom which liberates one from samsara, which shows one that suffering, all suffering, has now come to an end. So, when the Buddha taught his monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, disciples, he taught them Anapanasati in the following way. At first he would say to go to a quiet, empty place somewhere. A place like this, where you are not distracted or disturbed by either too many sounds, too many duties, or too many people. You come to a quiet place, and there you sit on a comfortable seat, as I was mentioning last night, the middle way, avoiding the extremes of indulgence or asceticism. We don't sit on beds of nails in this tradition, nor do we go to bed on water beds or queen beds. We have somewhere in between where we can be comfortable but not indulging. It's for that reason that it's usually best to do meditation in either walking or sitting postures. You can meditate lying down, but usually the mind regards the time when you lie down as the time to sleep. It's very difficult to train the mind to lie down and not to sleep, to lie down and keep aware. You can do that if you really wish to. But the best postures, the ones which people usually get the most insight and most calm from, are the sitting postures and the walking postures. So you sit down on a comfortable place. So with the back erect, bringing mindfulness in front of you. It's just setting up mindfulness. When the Buddha said put mindfulness in front of you, it didn't mean just on the tip of the nose or on the lip or somewhere in front of your eyes. It just means that put it in front, make it important, set it up carefully at the very beginning. And where the Buddha says to set up mindfulness, this is achieved through what I call my first 2 stages of meditation, present moment awareness and silence. That is the setting up of mindfulness, of clarity. Because if you're not in the present moment, basically you're not mindful of what's happening. You're not aware, you're not present. So how can you be mindful? And if you're busy talking to yourself, how can you be listening to what's said? How can the world be teaching you when you're busy talking about something else? So that mindfulness is established through this practice of present moment awareness and silence, the preliminaries. And in all types of meditation, whether it's on metta bhavana, whether it's doing mantras or whatever, just those first two stages are very important. Present moment, awareness and silence. And those first two stages are something which you can practice at any time, not necessarily on the meditation cushion, not necessarily on a walking meditation path, just even when you're driving your car, just when you come to the red traffic lights, you stop. Present moment awareness. Don't turn on the radio, just be silent. Remember where you are. And that's why I say that even though there are no temples in all countries, even though that sometimes it's hard to find good monks, good nuns, good teachers in many countries, you can always find red traffic lights in all countries. They are your Buddhist teachers. They tell you, stop. As if the Buddha is saying those words himself. Stop. As you rush to work, as you rush back home, as you rush to go somewhere and do something, the red traffic lights are the Dhamma in every crossroads of every city in the world, saying, stop. Unfortunately, the people don't stop. In Perth, we have these red light cameras which catch people in their cars going over the red traffic lights. It would be wonderful if you could have these mind red light cameras which catch people's minds going past the red stop light as their minds go off to work, leaving their car still at the red traffic light. Stop means being still, present moment, not going anywhere. So this is what we do at the very beginning of meditation. We sit on our meditation, a cushion or stool, chair, and we stop. That's present moment awareness, that's silence. And then the Buddha says that to really get into very deep meditation, you have to give up the diversity of the world, where all these five senses and all the myriad of impressions which these five senses can attend to are all given away as you just deliberately attend to one thing. And the Buddha was saying here to attend to the breath. The first stage is just to know a long breath as it goes in, to know a long breath as it goes out. That's all. To know the breath. The second stage in Anapanasati, second of the 16 steps, is to know a short breath as it goes in, know a short breath as it goes out. Usually, it's not always the case. When a person starts meditating, because the body has been active, because it needs more oxygen, the breath is usually long. As you relax and settle down, the breath just becomes short by itself. Because you don't need so much oxygen to give the energy for the body. The body's relaxing. And so it's quite natural that those two steps follow one after the other. But not always, though. The whole point of those first two stages is just to know the breath. Instead of focusing on too many things, all you're doing is focusing on one. And the third stage is already quite deep, where you're supposed to know the whole of the breath. In Pali it's sapakaya patisamvedi, to be able to experience all of that breath. So this is where, instead of just watching in-breath, out-breath, or long breath, short breath, you're seeing the breath from the very beginning of each in-breath. From the very start, when it originates out of the silence, and see it grow to its peak, and then see it fade away again, until the in-breath is completely subsided, is stopped. To be able to have that degree of clarity, you even see the space between the breaths. The in-breath has stopped, the out-breath is yet to arise. There's a pause there. You'll be able to see the out-breath begin, grow to its peak, and then fade away into nothingness again. That's what we call the whole of the breath. It's similar to when you're doing your walking meditation, to be able to notice the feet moving as you walk. From the very beginning, when the left foot starts to move up from the ground, to watch every movement as it goes forward, until it finally reaches the ground, is flat on the surface, and that one step is finished. You notice the pause between the steps before the right step begins to move. And then you see the beginning of the right step. See the foot move up from the ground. My foot goes backwards a little bit first of all, before it goes forward. And then it reaches the ground. The ball of my foot, I don't know if your feet are the same as my feet. My feet were made in England, your feet may have been made in Singapore, Australia. Different model, but my foot, the ball of the foot goes down first of all. Now notice all the different movements of the foot. That's knowing the whole movement of walking, including the pauses between steps. In the same way in the breath meditation, you know the whole movement of the breath from the beginning to the end. When you can watch the whole of the breath, then really you are meditating on the breath. There is no gaps between your awareness, a smooth, continuous awareness on one thing. That just takes a bit of patience to be able to focus. You can focus on many things in your life. You can read a book, putting your full attention on that for an hour or 2 hours. You can listen to some music for an hour and a half, completely absorbed in what you're doing. Here you're using that same faculty of sustained attention just to be with the breath. Later on, that ability to sustain your attention on the chosen thing will be so important for you to really penetrate to the reality of things. One of the reasons why wisdom doesn't arise in people is because when they see things, they cannot stay long enough with it to fully understand it. It's like instead of reading the whole book, you just look at the introduction and then you turn to the back page to see what the result was and you try and work out what's in the middle. So often in life, we're so restless, we cannot spend long enough with anything to really get to know it. To be able to know something, you have to hold it in front of your mind for many hours and allow the mind to investigate in silence, to really get to know it. For example, those of you who have a husband or wife, a partner in this life, do you really know that person? Even how long have you lived with them? There's always some new aspects, character traits, things about them which surprise you from time to time, which proves that even though you may have lived with that person for 5, 10, 15, 20, 40 years, that's still not long enough to know them. This is what I mean by sustained attention on one thing. So this third stage of the meditation is learning how to sustain your attention on one thing. If you're doing any other type of meditation, such as metta, bhavana, developing the focus of attention on loving kindness, again, you have to come to that stage of complete full awareness of loving kindness. So you're not aware of anything else. Just love is the only thing in your mind, sustaining your attention on it for a long, long time. There is a very lovely story which was told to me many years ago by Venerable Dhammaratana of KL, which shows just how this sustained attention on one thing works and develops. It's similar to the simile which I use of the television screen. Only this story was the story of a teacher who was teaching meditation to three students using archery as a means. Instead of meditation on the breath or loving kindness, he was using the skill of the bow and arrow. And having trained his three disciples for quite some time, he decided to give them a test to see if they really understood meditation. And he took a stuffed bird and he put it on a tree, on a branch of a tree, a long way away. It was that far away and that small, it would take a lot of skill out of the students to be able to shoot that bird. But the teacher told him, told the students, "I don't want you to shoot anywhere in that bird. To pass this test, that arrow would have to go through the left eye of that bird, nowhere else. Otherwise, you will fail." And he gave the bow and arrow to the first student and told him that the only way you can succeed is if you meditate on the target, the left eyeball of that bird, to make yourself one with that target, and only then release the arrow. Then the teacher told the student he can take as much time as he likes to meditate, to concentrate and make himself one with the target. But before he would shoot, the teacher asked for a sign from the student. And the student took a whole 30 minutes concentrating on the target, making himself one with the left eyeball of his bird. And he gave the teacher a sign. Before the teacher permitted him to shoot, he asked the student, "Can you see the bird on the tree?" And the student said, "Yes." And the teacher pushed him aside. "You stupid fool, give me the bow and arrow. Go and learn how to meditate some more." And he gave the bow and arrow to the second student and told him the same instructions. To concentrate, make yourself one with the target. I don't care how long it takes you. And when you're ready, give me a sign before you shoot. This student took a whole hour. And the teacher, once he was given a sign by the student, said, "Can you see the bird in the tree?" The student said, "What tree?" "Can you see the bird?" said the master. "Oh yes," said the student. And he pushed the student aside. "You stupid fool. Go and do some more meditation." And he gave the bow and arrow to the third student. When he gave it to the third student, he gave exactly the same instructions. And this time that student took a whole 2 hours, making himself one with the target, the left eyeball of that bird. And then he gave a sign that he was ready to shoot. And the master asked him the same question he's asked the first two students. "Can you see the bird on the tree?" The student said, "What tree?" "I can't see any tree." The master said, "Can you see the bird?" The student said, "What bird? I can't see any bird." The master said, "Well, what can you see then?" "All I can see is a left eyeball, that's all." "Marvelous," said this teacher, "shoot." And of course that arrow went straight through the only thing which was in that student's consciousness, just the target, the left eyeball of the bird. And that's a wonderful metaphor for meditation. If you focus on the target, in this case the left eyeball of a bird on a tree a long way away, if you really sustain your attention on that, first of all the tree disappears. And later on the body of the bird disappears. And all you're left with is the center, the focus of your attention, just the eyeball of the bird. This is what you're doing with breath meditation. This is where you're going to shoot the arrow of mindfulness. You first of all look at the breath, and there's many other things there. There's the breath on the body, its position in your body. And it's surrounded by all this universe which you're used to. If you keep focusing, 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 sustaining your attention on the target, after a while all that disappears and all you're left with is the breath, with nothing else there at all. That stage in this meditation where you just have the target in your mind, just the breath and nothing else, is called this third stage of meditation. Sabbakaya Patisangvedi, the full attention on the breath. There was nothing else in your mind at that time, just the experience of breath. Even though that might seem exalted, it's not all that hard. If you really want to, you can all attain that with great ease. I've given you some tricks to be able to do this. Tricks like to see the beauty in that eyeball of the bird. So keep sustaining your attention, have confidence in yourself, you can do it. Instruct your mindfulness, say this is what I want to do. Everything else, just remember these are enemies to my meditation, push them aside. I've talked about the five hindrances. If you really want to, you can do this. If you are a surgeon, a doctor, this is what you have to do when you're performing an operation. You have to have one point in this at the tip of your scalpel. Because if you just have one stray thought, if you're just distracted for a moment while you're performing an operation, snick, and that's that patient dead. If you really want to, you can be mindful. To the point where that's all that there is inside your mind. I've been talking to some surgeons, and they have to stand next to that body being operated on for many hours. And sometimes I wondered, that must really give you a lot of ache in your legs, to standing for hours around and bent over. It's probably bad for your back as well. And they say that no, when they're actually operating, they just forget completely about their body. Their attention is fully just on the scalpel and on the part of the body which they're working on. They become one-pointed. They experience stages of samadhi. So this is the complete awareness on the one thing. That complete awareness on one thing gives rise to a beautiful feeling of peacefulness. It's as if you've had so many things to deal with, and now you've only got one thing to deal with. It's as if you've had six telephones on your desk at work, and they all ring at the same time. You know how disturbing that is? You don't know which one to pay attention to. Now you've only got one telephone. It's a very, very soft and peaceful telephone at that. That's the difference. The mind only one thing to deal with. Once you have full attention on the breath, the next stage is where the beauty, the bliss, really has a chance to arise. It's called the Prasambayan Kaya Sankara, where you calm down that object of your mind, the breath. This is by giving the suggestion, just calm, calm, calm. So instead of just an ordinary breath, which you're aware of, you deliberately, by an act of will, calm that breath down. So instead of being an ordinary breath, it gets softer and softer and softer. Usually, with most meditators, as the breath becomes softer and softer and softer, then it gets more and more beautiful. You have to be careful here. Many meditators make a mistake. They start to calm the breath before they've got full awareness on it. And if you calm the breath, in other words, you do this fourth stage before you complete the third stage, if you haven't got full awareness of the breath yet, you calm it, that's where you go to sleep. You haven't got the image of the breath in your mind yet. You're already calming the little you have. Get the full attention on the breath, first of all. And when it's fully there, then calm that object inside your mind. It's like calming the eyeball of a bird. Only when you've got full attention on it should you try and calm it. And as you calm that breath down, you get to the fourth stage where the breath becomes very, very refined. The only thing in your mind still is very, very peaceful, very, very smooth. It is the nature of such a mind state that it should be very happy. However, this is a happiness of peace. And many people in the world can't recognize that happiness. even though it's there all the time, the mind is attuned to the happiness of excitement, the happiness of entertainment and stimulation. This is another type of happiness, and it takes some wisdom to be able to recognize it. And that is why that if you have calmed the breath down, if that doesn't give rise to the beautiful breath yet, the Buddha taught the fifth and sixth stages of meditation. The fifth stage of meditation is deliberately arousing feelings of joy with the beautiful breath. Sixth stage is deliberately arousing feelings of happiness with the breath. Those feelings of joy and happiness, they're there in the breath. Only sometimes you just haven't recognized it yet. Because it's not the happiness and joy of excitement, it's the happiness of peace. It's like a person who is used to, like rock music, goes to the first classical concert. They just, they can't understand just why people pay money for this. Because the mind cannot recognize the beauty of it yet. The mind was coarse, and it's now faced with something refined. It's like a person who spends most of their time eating a McDonald's or Kentucky Fried, and they go to a five-star French restaurant. They don't know why people pay all the money for this food, because their palate hasn't really got refined enough to appreciate this. After a while, you become very refined in your mental palate, so you can really appreciate the happiness of peacefulness. And when you get to that very calm breath, that happiness, that joy arises. If it does not arise spontaneously, the fifth and sixth stages should be applied. You should deliberately look for the happiness and joy in meditation. The breath is nice and peaceful, and you don't really feel it's all that happiness yet. Deliberately look for it. Ajahn Brahm and all these meditation teachers, they talk this is bliss. Well, I can't see any bliss yet. Where is it? Look. As I was saying this morning, all those perceptions, it was last night, all those perceptions which are available to you, one of those perceptions is happiness, one of those perceptions is joy. But a lot of times we miss taking that perception. So this is where we deliberately look upon the breath and try and see the happiness in it, try and see the joy in it. We deliberately develop the perception of happiness. This is again one of the important trainings in meditation which I'm teaching here. To be able to sort of take out the perceptions of happiness and joy in whatever you're doing here. Even when you go into the toilet, at last a comfortable seat to sit on. Make it happy, make it joyful. But don't nod off when you're on the toilet seat. And when you're eating, when you're sleeping, whatever you're doing. That's why yesterday in the interviews I told people to look upon this retreat, look upon meditation. Similar to when you were at school and you have playtime. This is playtime. It's not work time. So if you have that attitude to meditation, this is playtime. You're deliberately looking for the happiness and joy in meditation. If you get convinced that meditation is torture, then that's what you'll be looking for, and you never get to these deeper stages of meditation. The more I keep saying that meditation is the biggest bliss you can experience in the world, and as I was saying to someone yesterday, sometimes in meditation, sometimes you just don't know how you can take so much bliss. It gets more and more and more, and you think you've reached the limit of what you can endure, and it gets more and more and more. That you're going to bust up because it's just so beautiful. And I said that on purpose because it's going to get that expectation that you're going to look for that bliss. And that looking for that bliss is the fifth and sixth stages in this meditation. The Buddha advised you to do that. When the breath is very peaceful, search out for that bliss and you will find it. And that will be an important stage in the meditation. Experiencing this very peaceful breath, a very blissful feeling. In the way I describe meditation, I use the word the beautiful breath. Here the breath is still there, but it's just so beautiful. It's attractive, it's full of joy, it's full of happiness. You wonder why you ever want to look at anything else. The breath is more beautiful than a flower, more wonderful than a sunset. It's just so delightful, you think you can spend so much time with it. This is the stage of the beautiful breath. The feeling that happiness and joy, the fifth and sixth stages. The seventh stage is just feeling that whole. They call it a chitta sankhara. This is something which is manufactured by the mind, not manufactured by the body. This is a mental experience, although it can sometimes be felt in the body. Or it's as if it was interpreted as a bodily feeling, but really it's a mental experience. And to feel the whole of that. In other words, to allow that happiness and peace, or the happiness and joy, to be able to spread right throughout the breath. So the breath is wholly beautiful. From the very beginning to the end, it's just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful breath. By this time, it's most common that any perception of in or out is completely gone. It's just breath. It's like a continuous flow. You are actually breathing in and breathing out. But in that simile of the saw, which I was mentioning on the first day, when you're just focusing on the blade of the saw, which is hitting the wood, you just got no idea whether that particular tooth of the saw is at the beginning or the end, or the middle or somewhere else, on that whole row of teeth on the saw. In the same way, this bit of breath you're experiencing now, you don't know where it is. In relation to the beginning, to the end, in or out, it's just an experience of breath, that's all. It's very beautiful, very peaceful, experiencing this beauty throughout the whole of the breath. Very often at that time, the breath will completely disappear, and all you're left with is the beauty, the happiness. However, if it doesn't happen spontaneously, the Buddha gave the eighth stage or eighth step in Anapanasati. He said, calm down that chitta sankhara. Calm down the happiness, the joy. Because very often that happiness and joy can be just a little bit too disturbing. Can be a little bit too exciting. So calm it down. Very often for meditators who first start to experience any happiness and joy in the meditation, any bliss, there's always the wow response. Wow, at last, great, marvelous. And it goes, because you're too excited. Sometimes with too much fear, this is a bit much for me, I don't deserve this. And it goes again. Just be calm. The happiness and joy is happiness and joy which is born of peace, born of stillness. Born of silence. So be still, otherwise it will go away. I'll bring in now the Ajahn Chah's famous simile of the still forest pool. And remember this simile because it's just so beautiful. This was Ajahn Chah relating stories of when he was what we call a Tudong monk. He would wander from place to place and camp out in the forests, in the mountains, in the caves. For many years he did this, seeking solitude. And he said that once, or many times actually, he would wander through the forest and always look for like a river or a lake to camp by in the evening. Because he'd need the water to wash after a long day's walk and also water to drink. So he would camp, you know, by a lake or a river. And after bathing, after drinking, then he would use his sit meditation in the evening. Very often the monks would use like a mosquito net strung around an umbrella to keep the mosquitoes away. But he said one day he was sitting quietly by this still forest pool. And he said that when he was very still, it was evening time, the jungle animals would come out to drink. They wouldn't come out straight away, only when he was absolutely still. Because jungle animals were afraid of human beings. And if they could hear or see or smell the human being because of the movement, then they would not come near. That only when he's absolutely still would the jungle animals think that he wasn't there and come out to drink. And sometimes he'd keep his eyes open and see all these animals come out. He said sometimes he was so still that many other jungle animals came out as well. And sometimes he was that still, he saw some jungle animals who his father and friends had never told him about. Weird and strange animals who were so scared of human beings that very few people had ever seen them. He said they came out, strange and wonderful animals, which he never thought existed, but there they were, and they would only come out when he was absolutely still. And he said that's a very good metaphor for meditation. You have to be very, very still. The jungle animals, the bliss to come out. If you're not still, bliss will be afraid of you. It won't come out. And if you're very, very still, and bliss starts to come out from the jungle into your mind, you say, wow. And straight away, the animal turns around. It won't come out for days. It knows you're there. So this is why you should be absolutely still. And even though some beautiful states of mind or experiences come into your consciousness, don't disturb them. Remember the simile of the still forest pool. If you want these amazing experiences to stay in your mind, you have to be as if you're not there. So they don't think that anyone is watching them. So this is what happens when you calm everything, when you arouse joy and happiness in the mind. When you allow that joy and happiness to pervade the whole breath, and when you calm the whole thing down, what the most important animal which comes out is described in the ninth step in Anapanasati. That step is Chittam Patisamvedi. You experience the mind for this next step. This thing which I call the mind is very hard to experience. It's only at this stage can you really say you can see the mind. A lot of times people have all these theories and ideas of what the mind is. They can try and test it out with scientific equipment. They can write whole books about the mind. This is the only place where you can actually experience the mind. At this ninth stage, the way that mind is experienced is, I mentioned this before earlier on, this is what we call a nimitta. It's the reflection of the mind. Remember, the mind is that which is knowing. How can the knower know itself? Only like a person looks at their face in the mirror. Only that way can you see your face. You see a reflection. The reflection which you see here, the nimitta, is a very true reflection of the mind. It's as if the mirror has finally been cleaned of all of this disturbing dust and grime on its surface. And now at last you can see yourself. You can see the mind. Chittam Patisamvedi. That is this nimitta. And I mentioned yesterday, when that mind arises, it's not something which you can anticipate or expect or hope to describe. It's something which is very strange, which is very difficult to give language to, simply because the whole of language is built on similes. You know, we describe something as hard, like a brick, like soft, like the grass. We always use similes from the world of the five senses. the world of the mind is so different from the world of the five senses. When you first experience these states, you say, what on earth was that? You know it's a real experience, but you struggle to find language to describe it. You just use imperfect similes. It's sort of like a light. It's sort of like a blissful feeling. It's sort of like this, sort of like that. You know, it's completely different, but you have to somehow describe it to yourself. And that's why we keep on saying, well, you can sometimes experience this as a light, sometimes experience this as a feeling, sometimes experience it as a blue blancmange, or whatever else it is. Exactly the same experience, but you give it different words. This is where Chittang Patisamvedi, you experience the mind. For many meditators, that mind only flashes up very quickly and disappears again, because it's like the animal coming out of the forest. You react to it. As I said yesterday, a very beautiful insight which helped me enormously was to know that that nimitta which appears in your mind is just a reflection of that which knows that. It's a reflection of the knower. If that knower moves, so does its reflection. By staring in front of a mirror, if you move, so does the image in the mirror. So the only way to keep that nimitta still is for you to be still. For the knower to be absolutely motionless. However, that's a difficult thing to do, to be absolutely motionless. So what happens usually the first time nimittas come up? They come up only for a short time and then they disappear again. So you have to keep on meditating, developing these stages until you find the ability. It's just being still, that's all. Not doing anything. Not reacting. Being absolutely passive. The nimitta comes up by itself. They call this like abhipramodayang, chittang. Abhipramodayang means that you give it joy, you give it confidence. Instead of being afraid, you're at ease with the nimitta. It's the same when you meet somebody you've never met before. So often we're on edge because we don't know who they are, we don't know what to say, how to react. But after a while of knowing them, you get to be at ease with them. They're like a good friend. It's like many of you when you came here the first day. You're on edge because you don't know what to expect in a meditation retreat. Who's here and what the teacher's like. After a few days, you tend to relax. It's the same with this nimitta. When you get to know it a while, you can relax with it. It's a great friend. And then it stays. This is giving it joy, giving it friendship, giving it happiness. Again, one of the skillful means which I developed, which was very powerful, is when a nimitta came up in my mind, I deliberately give it the keys of my car. You drive. I gave it trust and confidence. Because so often, there's somebody inside of us who still wants to control all of this. Who still wants to drive the vehicle. I think you know the simile which I'm pointing to here. You still want to control this whole meditation. At this stage, I just give the keys of my car to the nimitta. You carry on. I've got so far, now it's up to you. So this is where I completely stop doing anything. I give my trust to that nimitta. That's the same as that 10th stage in this Anapanasati Sutta. Where you give joy, give confidence to that nimitta. And only then will that nimitta actually rest and start staying. Then the next stage is samadhan, chittang, which literally means you just sustain your awareness on that nimitta. These stages here, it's very hard to distinguish between them, because as soon as you give joy to that nimitta, confidence to it, it starts to become stable. It just stays there, all by itself. Remember that word samadhan, it's the same word as samadhi. Samadhi is sustaining your attention on it. It's keeping the mind still on that one thing. Mindful, clearly aware. You're just being with something. That's called samadhi. Even when you're reading a book, you're reading, 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 and you can't be distracted. That's samadhi as well, but only a very coarse form of samadhi. Because you're sustaining your attention on one thing. It's effortless, and you can't really be disturbed. When you get to, instead of being like dull, which you can start off with, it starts to become very brilliant and very, very powerful. And the signs of good nimittas are they're the most beautiful green you've ever seen in your life. Not just like the ordinary greens, which I'm looking at now out in the garden, but just a, I can't even say a vivid green, but just a very deep, beautiful green. Or white, gold, whatever color you wish. And this is what happens when you give it joy. So it's been polishing it up. It's shining so much. And then samadhan, where you just sustain your attention on that. The nimitta just stays. And the next stage, which is in the 12th stage, or the 12th step in anapanasati, is called vipochayan, chittang, where you free the mind. Here, the mind usually has one of two experiences, which are exactly the same, depends upon your perspective. Either you find yourself diving into the nimitta, that's how you can describe it afterwards. The attention, as it were, just sinks right in there. Or else that nimitta, that beautiful light or feeling, just completely envelops you. And then you enter the jhana through freeing the mind. The jhanas are called by the Buddha stages of freedom. Vimoka, he called it. Vimoka is the same word, only intensified of a person who's been in jail and has finally gained their freedom and walks outside. You may sometimes know it from the Sanskrit moksha. Vimoka is freedom. The mind is now free. And this is a very beautiful experience to find the freedom of the mind. This is the experience of jhanas, where the mind is free from the body. I'm not saying floating out anywhere, not an out-of-the-body experience. You're just not located in space anymore. All that space and time is all something to do with the body. Here the mind is free from all of that. You're just experiencing bliss. Not at all sensitive to what's happening with the body, unable to hear anything, unable to say anything, just blissed out, still, stable like a rock. These are like signs of the mind being freed. And that becomes one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, and enjoyable experiences of your life. If you get a few of those jhanas, then there's basically nothing you can do about it. You usually want to become a monk or a nun, because the world will not have so much pull for you anymore. Compared to the jhanas, sex, rock and roll, drugs, TV, travel, all that sort of stuff seems to be so unimportant, so stupid, just so sort of unattractive compared to the bliss of the mind when the mind is free. But not just like bliss, but just the philosophical profundity of it. And if you get into a jhana, you can call yourself a mystic, if you like. You've got an experience which, in all of the religious traditions, is a mystical experience, something which is far away from the ordinary. The Buddha called it Uttarimanusa Dhamma. It's like a thing which surpasses the ordinary human world. We call it the mind Mahagata, gods of greatness. We call it, as I said the other day, the happiness which is so similar to enlightenment happiness. We call it Sambodhisukha. So it's a place where defilements just cannot reach. So this is where the Buddhist Mara, the Buddhist devil, if you like, just cannot reach you. You're freed at this time. So you experience those stages through the first 12 steps of Anapanasati. They lead you all the way into these beautiful steps. But there's the last 4 steps of Anapanasati. When the meditator emerges from the jhana, the first thing you should do is to look back and review that state. How did that arise? What was that? This is general at all times in your meditation, at the very end. Always review your meditation. How do I feel? Why do I feel that way? What have I been doing all this time? What worked? What failed? And what is the result of this meditation? Why is it happy? All these reflections which will give rise to deep insight and wisdom. First thing after you emerge from a jhana is almost automatically say, wow, what was that? Investigate it and see if you can remember. Well, you will remember that experience. Then you'll struggle to give it words. Find out why that happened. Always you'll find the biggest 2 words which describe why that happened is always let go. You've really let go for the first time. Not let go of what you're attached to, but let go of the thing doing the attaching. You've let go of the doer. You've let go of the self. It's a hard thing for the self to let go of the self, but through this tricky stages, you've actually done it. And that's why it's bliss. So, having reflected on the experience, then you take up either the Satipatthana, or you can just go straight to the last 4 stages of Anapanasati. The first one is reflecting on Anicca. Not necessarily just impermanence, because I like the word Anicca as irregular. They have used the word Nietzsche, which is the opposite of Anicca. For any person who comes to bring food to the monks or the nuns regularly, say once every Wednesday or once every Thursday, that's called Nietzsche. When that which was regular stops, that's Anicca. What's important to reflect upon after the deep experiences of meditation is there was something which was so regular you took it for granted, you didn't even notice it. This thing we call the self. And jhana has disappeared. Look at that. And that will show you the truth of anatta in such a depth that it's very likely to give rise to the experience of stream winning. If that doesn't work, anicca, viraga. Viraga is the fading away of things. Sometimes it's called dispassion. It has this dual meaning, and I usually prefer the meaning of fading away. When things just disappear. You've seen a lot of things disappearing when you enter jhanas. A lot of things which were so close to you, again, you thought were just an essential part. It's all gone. In these jhanas, you're experiencing the fading away of things. As in the third reflection in Anapanasati, Nirodha, cessation. Now, sometimes I've picked up books of meditation teachers in the West, and they've got all these amazing, weird explanations of Nirodha. Nirodha means cessation, something which was once there. Has now completely disappeared. It's ended. Gone. Empty. This is what you can see through those experiences in deep meditation. So much of the universe which you knew has ceased. And you're in a completely different space. So much you thought was important has gone. Cessation. Cessation is also the third noble truth. Remember the third noble truth? The end of suffering is called cessation. And the cause of that cessation is called letting go. You've actually let go. dukkha has ended. A lot of it anyway, most of it, 99% of it. And what's left? What do you think will be left when dukkha ends? What's the opposite of dukkha? Happiness. The ending of dukkha is happiness. That's why you reflect on why this is the most blissful experience I've ever felt in my existence. And if you've got a degree of wisdom, degree of intelligence, you see that the bliss is because so much dukkha has ended. Imagine that you had this migraine for many, many weeks, many months, and someone came along and gave you this new medicine, just invented. Say it works for some, it doesn't work for everybody. And you take it and you find it works for you. Your migraine is gone. How would you feel? You'd just be as high as a kite, you'd be blissed out. Sometimes you'd be crying in happiness. That pain is all gone. The ending of pain is happiness. Why is it that, according to Australia, schoolies, when they finish their year 12 exams before they go to university, why is it as soon as they finish their exams, they feel so happy? Because a lot of suffering has just ended. So often, the happiness in the world is just a measure of how much suffering went before, how much you strived. Looking at the people in this room here, when you pay off your mortgage with your house, you feel so happy. Why is that? Because of all the pain of paying it off and working for months, years. That's why you feel happy. That's why if you're rich and you don't have a mortgage, you don't have that happiness. You are, disadvantaged. So, you experience happiness and you know its cause, Nirodha. And the last of the reflections in Anapanasati is this beautiful word, Patinisaka, letting go, abandoning. So I was reflecting on that word earlier this week. And a word like pati means, like nisagya, is just like giving something away. Pati means something which is in the opposite end, against. And just realizing that word, Patinisaka, is reflecting not on giving away what's out here, but giving away what's in here. Reflecting of giving away, abandoning all that's in here. A lot of times people think of Buddhism as just being unworldly, giving away all that which is out there, and they forget to give out what's in here. This is Patinisaka, the letting go of the inner world, the letting go of the doer, the letting go even of the knower. And after experiencing jhanas, if you look very carefully, you'll see that's what you've been doing. Not just letting go of the external world, but letting go of the internal world as well. Especially of the doer, the will, the controller. And you see that gives rise to so much happiness, so much purity, so much freedom, so much bliss. You found the way, the path, to the ending of suffering. So that's how the Buddha described the Anapanasati, as a complete practice which starts with just sitting down on a quiet place, back straight, mindfulness in front of you, just watching a long breath. Stage by stage, gradually, in steps which you know you can take if you can remember how to do them, you get all the way into these very profound and beautiful, blissful states of mind called the jhanas. When you emerge from afterwards, you have any one of these four things to contemplate: anicca, impermanence or irregularity, viraga, the fading away of things, nirodha, cessation of self, or patinisaka, letting go. If you reflect upon those things with the experience of jhanas, then something's going to happen. I often say that jhanas is the gunpowder, reflection is the match. If you have the two together, then it's like there'll be a bag somewhere. It's only a matter of time. So so may you always gaze at those beautiful banks. So that's the talk this morning about the Anapanasati Sutta. Any questions or comments about that this morning? Okay, have any questions or comments which come up later this morning, please write them on a piece of paper and I'll try and answer those this evening. In the meantime, it's now time to, having given all the instructions now, you know exactly what to do, now just go and do it. I expect at least to get to stage 14 or 15 this morning. So, even though you think this is beyond you, never think like that, because you just do not know how close you are.